Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, sad face. I'm very sad. I found out today, thanks to Bloomberg, because a Bloomberg report out saying Donald Trump is not building a presidential library. It's all on hold. And there are a bunch of reasons, but the big one is he's not ready to concede. And he may want to run again. So in his mind, having a presidential library means it's over. He's not going to be able to run in 2024. Now, look, I was looking forward to, whatever display he puts out. Because, look, I went to Dallas on George W. Bush's, whatever that is. They call it a presidential library. And I got to play with the little fun game, the little block of wood on the ball. I got to play decision maker. It was great. I was really looking forward to the gold toilets at the Trump Library, but not going to happen. And here to share some thoughts on maybe why it's not going to happen and a whole bunch of other things, I've asked our good friend Eric Loomis to come talk with us. Eric is a history professor, also a incredible author, has written the seminal book that must be read by every working person, A History of America in 10 Strikes. He also does the Lawyers, Guns, and Money blog. Just an all-around terrific guy. Eric, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you.
So what do you think? No Trump library. I was really looking forward to the men's room with all gold urinals.
I can't believe it. Donald Trump is the biggest narcissist in American history. He wouldn't want a giant palace to himself. You know, like, what? I would love to go to that for the exact same reason you would, because it would be crazy. Yeah, I went to the Nixon Library, and that was also insane. Like there is so much just totally bonker stuff there, and it was if you're a cynical historian, it was like Disneyland. And the Trump would be even better.
No, Trump would be fantastic. I mean, we went to the craziest one. I went to was the George W. Bush one. We hit up Truman's, we hit up Eisenhower's. We hit up Clinton's, we hit up Carter's. I've been to a bunch of them, but George W. Bush's was the best because it was like video interactive. They put you in a room and you get to play Decider Guy, or they come in with like a 2-minute video of, you know, just all kind of flash images of the stock market's crashing. Senator runs in, oh my God, the Senate's crashing. And then someone comes in, hey, do you want coffee? And there's all these decisions that you have to make. And then after the end of it, you have to then decide, because that's exactly how it works in the White House. And then at the end, when you decide, a video of him comes trotting out and he explains why he made the decision he made. And then he trots back out. It was fabulous. I spent like an hour playing Decider Guy.
I clearly need to get to Dallas again. That sounds amazing.
My other favorite game is they had this thing on a triangle. It was a triangle piece of wood about a foot on a ball that you were trying to figure out how to balance the powers, because you had the three corners being the three branches of government, and it was, you would balance it on the, it was a balancing game.
Do you think that's how George W. Bush made decisions in the White House? It's like just balancing games?
No, I'm sure that's the toy that Cheney gave him while he was making the decisions.
Right. Of course. That's exactly.
But you know, it was just one of those things where once you got past all the twisted metal and every video ever made of 9/11 that they could come up with, because when you walk into it, when you walk into the library, and this isn't where I wanted to go, but they have this giant wall of moneyed donors who have their name etched in stone on the, and those are the moneyed people. They wouldn't tell me how much it cost to get on the wall. I asked, but I think for like $2,000, you can get your name in the digital registry. I don't know how much it took to get in the giant, 5-foot blocks. But that's what you came to first. And then you went through the twisted metal of 9/11. And it was this huge display. And it was just angering and frustrating and crazy. But that's the Bush Library.
Yeah. As somebody who likes to visit the most disturbing places in America, that sounds like a real winner, because I'm sure it would drive me nuts.
Yeah.
Now I really want to visit.
Well, we went there in 2013 with the radio show. We had done our labor history tour. We went across the country and, we stopped in there to interview the curator, and they were really great to us. They gave us the grand tour. We got to sit in the old Situation Room. because they stole the old Situation Room. Because after 9/11, they realized just how antiquated our systems were, and that they went and they rebuilt the entire Situation Room so that it actually had like a TV in it instead of like a, you know, a telegraph or something. So they did that, and they stole the old one, and they put that in the library. So we got to interview a bunch of people in the Situation Room, which was kind of cool, to be honest with you.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean you have to be a real professional to get those kind of jobs. It's just that. And like decades down the line, it'll probably be more reasonable and like, you know, have a real analysis of that presidency. But right now, you know, if the president's still alive, it's just pure propaganda. And that really includes Clinton, too. I mean, oh, yeah. I'm sure the Obama one will be the same.
I don't think I'm going to the Obama one because I'm still angry. Maybe down the road. I had such high hopes, because I didn't buy the hope and change. But I was hopeful that there would be hope and change. And, you know, as a labor guy, it just didn't happen, which brings me to this moment. You know, I look at Joe Biden, and I'll be honest, Joe Biden is surprising me. I was expecting him to not be this active, but I'm happy. And I look at the fact that on day one, he fires Peter Robb, a guy who was part of the firing of the Patco workers. Very symbolic and an excellent gesture, gone. And then his number two as well. And now the PRO Act being included in the infrastructure bill, I think it's huge.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Biden is already, you know, on labor issues, gone well beyond anything Barack Obama did. You know, I don't think Barack Obama really cared that much about union issues. It got a little bit better in the second term, but still, he didn't care that much. And Biden clearly does. I think there's two things happening. I think one is that Biden himself has always had a soft spot for unions. You know, he comes from Scranton. That was a big part of his identity. He grew up around unions. He got unions in a way that Barack Obama didn't. So that's a piece of it. But I think it also is reflective of the fact that the American working class has become so much more angry and loud about being angry since 2008. And that hope and change wasn't going to work in 2020. People wanted something a little bit more real. And, you know, Biden is responding to those demands, the demands that started with Occupy now almost 10 years ago, that built through various political campaigns, through various strikes, through the fight for 15, through all of these moments. And frankly, you know, the rise of Donald Trump to some extent. And that Biden is responding to that. And I think that's positive because that shows that the president of the United States is actually listening to angry workers and unions for the first time in a long, long time.
No, I'm right there with you. And, you know, I'm saying now is not the time to stop being angry workers. Now's the time to ramp it up even a little bit and call your representatives, call your senators, you know, call early, call off and email, do all of that stuff, because I fear one of the bargaining chips of getting any infrastructure done is chucking out the PRO Act, much like they did with the $15 an hour minimum wage in the rescue plan.
Yeah, I mean, that is something that's possible. And I think that the bigger lesson right now is exactly what you said. Now is the time to double down on the pressure. Right now is the time to make more demands. You know, I mean, the point of politics is not to be a fan of the president. Right. It's not to see ourselves in the presidency. The job is to push those politicians to do what we want them to do, whether they're our allies or not. They respond to pressure. That's what we need to do here. And, you know, whether it's the PRO Act, the infrastructure bill, a future minimum wage bill, we need to keep that pressure on. Say, yes, thank you for the what gets passed. But really demand much, much more.
But ultimately, I come back to this, and I've been talking to a lot of new union members here recently, and I come back to it. I'm a registered Democrat, and I admit that, but I'm a labor guy first. I want nothing more than I want to see than a Republican Party who doesn't want to destroy labor unions the way they have the last 40 years. I don't want that to be on everyone's radar, but I'm a labor guy first, and the Democrats right now are kind of like the last place for a guy like me to be. I would love nothing more than to see a pro-labor Republican. I'll be honest with you, Eric.
Sure. I mean, look, if the Republican Party wants to live up to some of this attempts at rhetoric and actually push pro-worker policies, then you know what? If you feel that Republican would represent you as a worker, as a labor person, then I understand that. But they haven't done that in many, many decades, and there's no real evidence that they're going to. Donald Trump uses this kind of language, but then all of his policies, you know, just like somebody like Peter Robb, like the worst possible individual to name as the general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board, is who gets named, right? So Trump can use this rhetoric, but then in reality, it's the same old thing that Bush did, that Reagan did, you know, and so the Democratic Party, look, it may not be the greatest political party ever for organized labor. You know, I think we can all admit that. But the reality is that at least right now, unless Republicans start to shift on this, which could happen theoretically anyway with a lot of political pressure, then there's really, you know, if you support the idea of rights for workers or rights for yourself on the job, the Democratic Party right now is your only possible home.
Yeah. So for me now, the point is, again, pushing them in the direction that we want them to go. And I'll argue, and I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, the way they want to go. They need the pressure. And there's the famous story of, you know, I think it was Francis Perkins, you know, being told by FDR, you know, go out there and make me do it. You want me to move on something? Go out and get the support and make me do what I want to do. And I think that's a good story. If it's true or not, I don't care. It's a good story.
Oh, agreed. And because it's true, right? Because, you know, any president's going to have big money interest at his door every single day. Right. You know, he owes them for his candidacy, or they just have a ton of lobbying money. It takes real pressure from the people to get that kind of change. And too often we haven't organized enough to apply that pressure. And you know, some of that, again, the reason that the Biden administration has been pretty good so far on labor issues is that that pressure has been existing now for about 10 years. It's gotten more and more organized, more and more demands. And we're seeing at least the beginnings of a payoff for that now.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of it, you know, I keep coming back to this PRO Act as, you know, and I know a lot of my labor friends are like, you know, this is kind of like the last hope. I'm not quite as in that desperation, because I always think that eventually people have had enough of you know what, and they eventually organize and they eventually, you know, turn around and demand. But, you know, we're kind of at the end of the rope, aren't we?
Well, like you, I mean, the workers' movement will never die. You know, workers are always going to be organizing. It ebbs and flows, and obviously it hasn't been great in the last many years. But, you know, to me, the PRO Act is actually a sign of improvement, right? I mean, under the Obama administration, you know, the big legislative agenda for the labor movement was the Employee Free Choice Act, which really ultimately was pretty limited. It was not a big game changer like the PRO Act is, right? It's true, the PRO Act would really fundamentally transform labor relations in the United States in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. I mean, it's worth remembering that the last comprehensive pro-labor legislation to pass, to be enacted into law, was the Fair Labor Standards Act all the way back in 1938. So we're talking now about 83 years without comprehensive labor legislation. And that's what the PRO Act is. It's really comprehensive. And moreover, I think that this is also significant, right? It has passed the House of Representatives. And, you know, yes, it faces the Senate, and yes, there's that filibuster issue, and that's a big, big, big issue. But I think that the bigger point now is that unlike not only in the Obama years, but not in the Clinton years, not in the Carter years, not even in the LBJ years, basically the entire structure of the Democratic Party supports comprehensive labor reform. And that's a place that we simply haven't been in a long, long, long time. And that is something to take positive about, right? That's something to really be heartened by. Because without that kind of support, you know, you're not going to have any law. The thing has already passed one house of Congress. And, you know, I don't know if every Democratic senator would vote for it as it is. We're not at that point yet. But nonetheless, we are taking a big step in the right direction. So, you know, there's reasons to be optimistic about this.
No, and look, I look at what's happened at Amazon. And I think, you know, this is an interesting moment because you've got a president who is talking all the right things. He came out and gave what I think is, you know, probably a historic 2-minute video on, you know, workers' rights and workers being able to join and form unions. And then you have this Amazon campaign, which has been ugly and nasty and has been right in front of us every dirty trick that the union busters have been doing and getting away with for decades right in front of us. And I think this is a moment where the American people watching this, are going, it shouldn't be this difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about that, and that, and that, you know, if you're just an everyday person at home, you know, you don't really know about this kind of union busting stuff unless you're really paying attention to it, which means automatically you're not an everyday person at home. And you know, now it's in the news on a daily basis. Now the president of the United States is giving a video speech saying that workers should have the right to choose whether they want a union without employer interference, a truly unprecedented moment in American history. And so, you know, the political establishment is paying more attention to this. Like, people always wanted the president of the United States to speak out in favor of unions. Well, that's just happened, right? That pushes energy toward this issue. It pushes attention toward this issue. It educates people about this issue. And I don't know what's going to happen with this Amazon vote. You know, as you point out, they pulled out all the stops, and it is a nasty campaign. But even if they didn't win, it still is building attention. It's the anger among the working class is still there, and it's building, and it's beginning to leverage power in a way it hasn't in a long time. And so, you know, I don't usually get over optimistic, but I feel not bad about where we are right now. And you know, I don't, that's about as happy as I usually yep. get these days.
I see. I'm right there with you. I use the guarded optimism. I'm guardedly optimistic. I'm not ready to, you know, to take to the bridge, because, you know, we're at a moment where things are looking in the right direction. And, you know, the thing is, you know, our history, and I think this is an opportunity to talk about the history of labor in this country, which is one of the bloodiest, one of the most violent, you know, histories that of any country with their workers. We have a deadly past that most people have never learned about. And, you know, like I said, your book, I think, is important. I think every working person should read A History of America in 10 Strikes, because, you know, these are the big ones. These are ones that that made massive changes.
Yeah, I mean, look, again, I don't know what's going to happen in Amazon right now. But if you look back to how Ford got organized, or U.S. Steel, or GM, or the coal mines, the rubber mills, these were decades long struggles. With losses, with murders, right, with massacres of workers, where it looked hopeless and was hopeless at times. And then after decades of struggle, finally in the 1930s, a combination of organizing and conditions and politicians all come together, and you have the formation of, like, the classic period of American labor where unions actually win. And that's kind of what we sort of remember today more, is a big, powerful United Auto Workers and United Steel Workers and et cetera. And of course, we're not in that moment anymore, and we're wondering why. Well, a lot of what's happening now is we're recreating that earlier period where I don't know how long it's going to take to organize these places. You know, look, if Amazon workers win this vote, it could be pretty rapid. Like, that would potentially be the, you know, an equivalent of a Flint sit-down strike, an equivalent of the steel workers getting that first contract with U.S. Steel. Like, it could be a world-changing event. But if it doesn't happen, we do have to understand that sometimes these things take decades, and we just have to keep organizing and keep fighting. Amazon is eventually going to be unionized. So is Walmart. So is Target. We need to organize the gig economies. These struggles today that seem like they're taking forever and seem hopeless, they're no different than where we were 100 years ago, in the middle of a long organizing process to build a working class economy. And sometimes that takes a long time.
No, I keep saying, you know, it's a 100-year cycle. We're coming out of a global pandemic just like 100 years ago. We're going through the same kind of organizing just like 100 years ago. And it's going to take a while. My kids are going to have to fight the fights of their great-great-grandparents. And sadly, that's the reality.
Yeah, I mean, as much as we don't want that to be true, we want these instant victories and, you know, a return to 1950s. Union power, that's not going to happen overnight, right? That's a decades-long project. And it's tough to admit to ourselves that that's true, but that is, in fact, where we are. And to recognize that means that you start, I think it's important, because you get rid of nostalgia, which doesn't help organize, and you start finding the new pathways to organize a new economy, an economy that's different than it was in 1950. An economy that has a different industries, different types of workers, a different, you know, more sophisticated union busting tactics, all of these things are just different than they were, you know, 100 or 70 years ago. But you have to recognize where you are in order to move forward and actually organize the new economy.
No, it's an excellent point, because, you know, there's a well-organized campaign of people who are pushing against the PRO Act because of the ABC test. And I got, you know, hammered by a bunch of people saying, oh, you hate women because women are gig workers and they want the flexibility of being their own boss. And I go, you want the flexibility of being exploited. You want to be cheated every turn. Is that what you're telling me? You know, we talk about women wanting equality. Being cheated like this is not equality. But there is a well-coordinated attack on that front, Eric.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, the propaganda network to convince workers that bosses are in their interest is incredibly sophisticated, you know, and it really comes out of the New Deal and the Great Depression, where businesses all of a sudden found themselves in a place that they weren't dominant anymore. And even all the way back in the 1930s and 40s, the roots of figuring this out, and how do you put propaganda in the media to create the idea of employers as the worker's friend and the union is the enemy, that's already existing, right? And you know, you create these sophisticated networks of propaganda, you know, with legal sides of it, political sides of it, and media sides of it to, you know, convince workers that, you know, that working as a gig worker, which is fine, there's nothing wrong with that, right? But the idea that you would become an employee suddenly means that you're no longer in charge of your own future, right? That you're, as these people cynically point out to you, you must oppose women at the workplace because you want them to have rights on the job, right? Well, the idea of a union is that you have rights on the job. And even the gig economy, the part-time workers exist, right? I mean, you know, that doesn't mean that you have to work a 40-hour week. There's just so much cynicism. But it's a cynicism that is a lot of money behind it. And it's very effective at convincing workers that employers are their friends. And again, I think slowly we're starting to repeal that and push away from that. Yeah. But again, these things take time. They take organizing.
No, and this idea that there's a benevolent employer. You know, I tell people, this is a good company you're working for. They're not bad. The union fought for everything that you're getting from them. They're good, but they're not benevolent. They didn't give you this stuff out of the goodness of their heart. People fought and bled and died for it. That's why you don't take it for granted and you don't let it go easily. At least part of my thoughts. Last question I've got for you. You know, looking at this PRO Act, do you have any hope that this gets through? Any insight, any thoughts?
Well, I mean, so long as the filibuster is there, no. But I mean, I think that what's happening right now is that with all of this stuff backing up, right, the PRO Act being one of them, but also, you know, the act, the Voting Rights Act, and these other pieces of legislation that are going to be coming down the line from a Democratic House, it's putting more and more pressure to either eliminate the filibuster or reform the filibuster. And we have to understand this is going to take a little bit of time, right? That if you do have, now, if you had more Democratic victories in 2022, where you got yourself three or four more Democratic senators, then you have a lot more leeway to do some of this stuff. Right now, you know, you do have to convince Joe Manchin that it's in his interests. And I'm not convinced that Manchin would really oppose the PRO Act. I think there's other things he would oppose more, because West Virginia also has that union background, and it's something that he is at least familiar with, you know, in a way that some senators maybe aren't. But it's going to be tough so long as the filibuster's there. But that's not a reason to give up or be hopeless. It's a reason to keep pushing, keep putting the pressure on, because some of the pressure is to get rid of the filibuster and convince those reticent Democratic senators that it's in their interest to do so.
Since you brought up the filibuster, I got to follow up on this, because Schumer now thinks he's found a loophole, I guess, by amending the last thing, or a budget. I've been asking for a while, because a budget is 12 individual bills. Why couldn't you run 12 individual bills and use those through the continuing resolution process? You know, just a thought.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Senate rules are so weird and arcane and almost impossible for everyday people to understand, in part because I don't think the senators understand them very well. you know, and Schumer just sort of discovering this somehow. I don't really know how that works since he's been in there for decades. But nonetheless, right. I mean, it may be that that the rules change where the filibuster is still there, but then there's this other stuff that gets created that is a work around the filibuster. And with the really broken political system that we have with a Senate that's so ridiculously undemocratic, you know, it's entirely possible that this is somewhere on a road to a solution. So, I mean, I saw Schumer said it today, and I'm like, okay, good. Maybe this is a pathway forward. And again, we have to keep pushing and encouraging him.
It's a workaround to you having any courage to actually doing away with the filibuster. So it is that. But Eric, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff, my friend.
Hey, thank you very much.
Good stuff. Eric Loomis, make sure you check out his book, A History of America in 10 Strikes. We'll get links out on how you can do that. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people. Come to talk.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.